Dhamma brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen and friends, it is my honor duty to welcome all of you to join the Peace of Mind, Ajahn Brahm's Hong Kong Teaching Tour 2015. And tonight's topic is the meaning of human life in the universe with evidence from Buddhism and science. And I'm asked to introduce Ajahn before the talk. And I think this is the most honor and very easy task, because I'm going to say this: Ajahn is the most beautiful and popular monks in this planet, period. Is that right? Rather than give you many hard information, I want to take just a few minutes to share with you my personal connection with Ajahn. Actually, Ajahn is my preceptor for my temporary Samalira, Dunke Chekage Dosi, Samalira preceptor. And I remember still vividly in my mind when I lead down in front of Ajahn, I supposed to be a very happy person because I'm going to experience the monkhood. But one thing I cannot let go is, to be honest, Ajahn, is my hair. I used to, okay, spend hours before I go to work for my hair. So I have some difficulty letting my hair go, okay. And when the moment came, Ajahn looked at me into my eyes and touched my head, goes like this: "It's not easy, right?" And for that blink of moment, I feel immediately connected with my master. Because at that moment, I feel this Buddhist teacher in front of me is not from the mass, okay? He is a friend of mine because he understands me. And I feel very, very safe that I can learn from such a master. And ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, I would like to introduce to you Ajahn Brahm.
Thank you. Those are always very nice words that he says about me. And I was just saying before we came in here that I am a very humble monk. But if you are humble, you must tell everybody about it. There's not much point of being humble if nobody knows. So the topic this evening is, again, the nature of human life in this universe from a Buddhist and a scientific perspective. And my background straddles the two, as a Buddhist and also trained in theoretical physics at Cambridge, and always kept up with the latest developments and managed to have great discussions with great professors. And so I'm going to begin with an anecdote of when I was giving a presentation at a science and religion conference in Australia many years ago. And there was a very honest woman who was a Catholic, a senior Catholic, and she said in her presentation that when she looks in a telescope to the stars and the heavens, that her religion feels threatened. You know, she was very honest with that. You know, some of the things that which we read in those ancient texts seem to be overturned, you know, by modern, especially astrophysics. But then, when I came to my turn to speak, I said, yes, but much of science is threatened if you look in the other way through the telescope, from the big end to the little end, to see who is actually watching all of this. And so in this presentation about the nature of life, we're not looking out there into the universe. We're looking in the opposite direction as who is actually doing this looking to begin with. You know, who is this observer? Who is this life, you know, which inhabits this universe? You know, is it part of the universe? It's like many people think that it's, you know, somehow different, that when we look, we're like objective, or when we look, do we change things? And part of the wonderful thing about being a Buddhist monk is that you can actually start to look at life, and I call it from outside the box. Because as a monk, we live outside the box. Therefore, we can see outside the box. And sometimes that, you know, the radical ideas of religion, when, you know, you are allowed to meditate, to see, to think things in a different way, you can be very, very creative. So, I've always been interested in the evidence which comes not just from meditation, but the evidence which comes from life itself. And I begin with a piece of evidence which arose in the early 80s from a Professor John Lauber of Sheffield University. It was published in the journal Nature in 1981, I believe. And it was called The Boy with No Brain. Because Professor Lauber, his field of expertise was the shape of the human skull. And he would do experiments, you know, which weren't intrusive, on people whose skull shapes were slightly deformed. And he knew more than anybody else, you know, what a natural skull shape was and what was deformed. And so whenever he saw a student on his campus in Sheffield whose head shape was slightly out of the ordinary, he would offer him a few British pounds to come on to the research program. And in those days, a few pounds for just sitting there doing nothing or answering a questionnaire was well worth it. So he had many volunteers. But one day, walking through campus, he saw this young man whose skull was deformed. And he invited him onto the program. This young man was doing postgraduate work in mathematics. He'd got a first-class honours at the first level, the bachelor's level, and now was doing a PhD in mathematics. He was socially well-adjusted, had a steady relationship with a girlfriend. And if anything, you know, he was more normal than normal. But when Professor Lauber gave him a CT scan of his brain, he was very shocked to find there was no brain. He became known as a boy with no brain. Now that's what Professor Lauber wrote. More accurately, he had 1% of the cortex. 99% was missing. It was cerebral fluid. And now, because I love this research too, I'm going to ask you to please move your head back and forth like I'm doing. And can you hear any sloshing? If you can hear sloshing inside, maybe we'll do an MRI scan of your brain. Maybe you've only got cerebral fluid in there as well. But there, only 1% cortex. Nothing else was there. And he had memory, he had social abilities, he had emotions, and he was doing, you know, postgrad work in mathematics. A brilliant guy, but without a brain. And I've seen those CT scans, and so some of my friends, you know, who are in that field. And that challenges neuroscience to its core. Please explain that if you can. A mind, intelligence, without a brain. Now, I know that some neuroscientists start to explain, well, you know, other parts of the brain can actually take over the functions of parts which are damaged. But no neuroscience can actually, no scientist can actually explain why it is that only 1% is there, and still all the other functions which you normally associate with human life are there, functioning. And these are some of the things I love about science. Not the things which prove what we already know, but the things which challenge what we already know. And that is why I became a Buddhist, simply because, you know, the whole point of, you know, the religious quest of Buddhism was to challenge, to be unorthodox. And many of you who know my story know I've already been excommunicated once from my ordination of nuns. And the wonderful thing about being excommunicated is you can only be excommunicated once. Now I'm excommunicated, I can say and do whatever I want. You are now intellectually free. So I encourage you to be rebels. And one of the stories which I very like, and one thing which I was at Dalhousie in Halifax just last October, and I mentioned this to the president, and he was really considering changing the motto of the university to this little saying, where everybody thinks the same, no one thinks at all. And that's a great motto for a university, where everybody thinks the same, no one thinks at all. So hopefully I can challenge people, because I've got a scientific background, I know a lot of what I'm talking about, but also have a Buddhist background as well to challenge. So first of all, the nature of consciousness, the nature of mind, the nature of life. Who is looking through the telescope? Who is taking the measurements? What is this thing which we call the observer? And first of all, from science, you know, from anyone here, has anyone here done quantum physics apart from the people in the front? Very, very few maybe. Please argue with me if I get it wrong. But, you know, the great Schrodinger's equation, where, you know, the quantum experience of the universe, description of the universe, is the whole universe is a smear of probabilities. It is not the universe as we see it, as we feel it, as we hear it, but it's a smear of probabilities. That is the base, the reality. And whenever we make an observation, they call it an observation, but a knowing, a measuring. Whenever we make that measurement, the Schrodinger equation collapses, and one out of many probabilities becomes our reality. And of course, the best description of that was the famous Schrodinger's cat thought experiment. Now, this is an experiment which no Buddhist who is a pacifist who loves animals should ever actually do. So please excuse me, because it wasn't my idea, it was Schrodinger's. He said, put your cat in a box, seal it. And in that box is a cyanide capsule. And that cyanide capsule would break, instantly killing the cat, if a cesium atom decayed in a certain amount of time, because the decay of a cesium atom is a quantum process. And you can arrange it pretty simply to give a 50-50 chance in a certain time of that cesium atom decaying and the cyanide capsule breaking and the cat being poisoned. And just at that moment before you open the box, where there's a 50-50 chance of that cyanide capsule having been broken, at that time, before you open the box, is the cat alive or is the cat dead? And the answer is neither. It's neither dead nor alive. It is a third state. Now, I don't know what the cat thinks about that, but as far as science is concerned, that is reality. And just last week, I was over in Mountain View, over in Silicon Valley. And I was invited, but didn't have the time to go, to see a quantum computer superpositioning where the quantum process, where it can be one thing or another, and no one really knows. It is actually Schrodinger's equation, Schrodinger's cat in action, creating a most modern computer with far greater number-crunching power than anything we've seen before. The closest thing we can probably have to artificial intelligence, which redefines what we mean by life in this universe. But here we're supposed to be talking about human life. But that particular experiment, that particular part of physics, was the first time hard science had to include intrinsically life, an observer, something which knows the universe. And you know that old philosophical conundrum? If a tree falls in a forest and there's no one there to see or hear it, has it fallen? And quantum physics says it's neither fallen, nor it's not fallen. It is in between until someone makes an observation, until a mind
till life intervenes. And the other place where life intervenes, please correct me if I've got this wrong, because this won a Nobel Prize for somebody after I became a monk. Remember, many of you may have heard of the second law of thermodynamics. Just that, you know, things get more complex, entropy increases all the time, except in a closed system with life. Life is an organizing principle which goes against Newton's second law of thermodynamics. Again, life interfering with objective science. Now, we know that we cannot have this world without life. It always has to be there somewhere. So what is this life? As far as science is concerned, it's important, it's fundamental. You know, if there wasn't human life here, basically there would be no universe. Period. It's a great statement to make, because most people have this concept of the universe being here, just like a house which may be vacant, and we can come in and just visit it. But science tells me that when you go into the house, you change it, you create it. It wasn't there before you entered. Weird, but true. So, what is this thing which knows the universe, the observer, the mind according to Buddhism? Already, sometimes that people in neuroscience who say the mind is some side effect of the brain, then when people don't have a brain, but they have a mind, then that challenges that particular idea. Now, you know, in science, one thing which I was taught, one thing which made it a seamless transition from being a scientist to being a Buddhist monk, was that we were always extending the way we look to the universe. Not thinking about it, but changing the fundamental way that we look at things. And an example for you, which I always found was fascinating and was actually extending our ideas, that you know that 300, 400 years ago, most people in our world thought the Earth was flat. They were flat earthers. And please, you must acknowledge, before Galileo, the Chinese, you found out that the Earth was round much before Galileo. And so now we all, these were rational people. They just viewed, they perceived this world as flat, and you couldn't convince them otherwise. And of course now we all believe the Earth is round, but I remember as a kid, before I did my science, wondering about the universe, especially the edge of the universe, the boundaries of the universe. And just with flights of fantasy, if you could go far enough, fast enough, can you get to the edge of the universe? And what would happen at the edge of the universe? Would there be a big wall set up by the universe government, prohibited for going further or you'll be shot? Or would you have barbed wire, razor wire fences like around Guantanamo Bay? And of course, whenever there's an edge to the universe, you always imagine, what's beyond that edge? What's the other side of the wall? Is there just a void on the other side of the wall? What is at the edge? And you know, it was never intellectually satisfying there could be an edge to this universe. And of course, later on, you know, in science, we understood there is no edge to this universe. It is a finite volume without any edges or boundaries. How can that be? And the answer was the simile of the ant crawling over the soccer ball, or the basketball if you don't know footballs. And an ant goes around that soccer ball, round and round and round and round it goes, and it soon realizes, it retraces its steps, that the area of the football is limited, but there is no edges or boundaries. And if you extend that simile to another dimension, that is the simile to understand this universe is limited in volume, but it has no edges or boundaries to it. And most people in science understand it's not a flat universe, it's a round, curved universe with no boundaries, limited size, but no boundaries. Now let's go to the next stage, time. Too many people these days are flat timers, which means they think it's got edges to it, boundaries, beginnings and ends. And when we have a beginning to time, that's where we have all sorts of religious and philosophical problems. The God, the Big Bang. Well, what was before the Big Bang? And all those ideas all become totally irrelevant when we stop being flat timers and curved timers. Time, limited duration, but without any boundaries or edges. I don't know how many of you have seen the film just out recently, The Theory of Everything, you know, Stephen Hawking's biography. I saw that on the aircraft coming here because I knew I was going to give this talk. Stephen Hawking, the originator of the Big Bang Theory, who now, he was stating what I've just told you, a universe without boundaries, time without a beginning, or without an end. No need for a creator, an originator. No need for a first cause, because time too has no boundaries. And that's what I learned from Buddhism. Beginningless time with no end, but circles which go round and round. That was intellectually satisfying. And to me it meant you don't need to have the God idea anymore. You don't need a creator if there's no beginning of time. A universe without boundaries. And at the end of that film, apparently that's what even Professor Hawking was establishing. A beautiful universe with no edges, no more flat timers, but curved timers. The next stage of our intellectual development, changing our framework of how we look at this world, physically. Now I'm going to go back to the human mind, which can observe all of this. You know, sometimes we always think about, you know, this human mind. Sometimes people call it a soul, a consciousness, and we spend our lifetimes trying to figure out what it is. And I think, and I'm positing this, that trying to search for the nature of the mind, consciousness, as a byproduct of the brain. There's too much evidence which, to me, says that that is a dead-end street which will lead you nowhere. And why can't we just change the way we look at things? Just like from flat Earth to round Earth, flat universe to curved universe, flat time to curved time, why can't we now take another step and understand the nature of the human mind? And to understand it, there's this little simile, a very easy philosophical argument, which I've never managed to find anyone who can refute it, but whose consequences are fantastic. And this all comes from a letter which I received from a college friend, who is still my best friend from my Cambridge years. He didn't become a monk, he became the consul, the British consul in Macau, just down the road from here. Lived in Hong Kong for many years, now retired. But when he had his first child, and that child went to school, went to the grade one, the first year at primary school or elementary school, whatever you call it, just the teacher asked the class a simple question: what is the biggest thing in the world? One child put the hand up, my daddy, my daddy, my daddy is the biggest thing in the world. And if you've had a little child, you know that they look up to their daddy, and in a child's eyes, in a five-year-old's eyes, daddy is huge. Another child put up his hand, no miss, no miss, an elephant is much bigger than her daddy. No, no, a mountain, miss, a mountain is the biggest thing in the world. It's getting better. And the daughter of my friend said, no, my eye is bigger, is the biggest thing in the world. And the teacher just paused, apparently, and didn't understand what this five-year-old meant. And then the five-year-old explained, well, my eye can see her daddy, My eye can see an elephant and a mountain and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. It's a very brilliant argument from a five-year-old who later went on to do post-PhD research in, I think, biochemistry in Oxford. Brilliant at five, continued to be brilliant throughout her whole life. Seeing things in different ways. And when I received that little beautiful anecdote, I gave her 9 out of 10, not 10 out of 10. Because your human mind, consciousness, I don't care what you call it, but I think you know what I mean. Your mind can see everything your eye can see. And it can imagine things you'll never see in the real world. It can hear real and imaginary sounds. It can smell, taste, feel real sensations in your body and imaginary ones as well. And it's also got its own area of knowledge. In fact, everything you can ever experience can fit into your mind. So the mind is the biggest thing. You may notice I never said biggest thing in the world, because the world can fit into your mind. The whole universe, the whole of science, the whole of music, everything, the whole of art, the whole of human endeavor, culture, knowledge, discovery, all of that can fit into your mind. Therefore, the mind is the biggest thing. It's just a different way of looking. But it has great consequences. This is the nature of human life. It's not human life coming into this universe. It's this universe coming in to the mind. And this takes me on to the immaterial nature of the human mind, existing without form, without matter. And of course, this is what monks do when we experiment with meditation. And I'm talking about the deep meditations. The deep meditations when everything stops. The body stops. Anecdote. But apparently, these experiments were done to prove this on Hindu yogis going into deep meditation. One of my disciples went into a very deep meditation one day. He was staying at home on a Sunday afternoon. Nothing was on the TV. And he told his wife, "Darling, I'm going into the bedroom to meditate for half an hour." An hour and a half went past. He hadn't come out. So his wife went into the bedroom to check on him. And there he was meditating perfectly still. Too still. She couldn't see his chest go up or down. He looked like he was dead. So she called in Australia 911. In Hong Kong, is it 999? The emergency. The ambulance came in 5 minutes. She was so scared. The medics came out. They felt his pulse. There was no pulse. So they put him into the stretcher, straight into the ambulance, and they were rushing to the nearest hospital, going through all the red lights. This was emergency. There was no heartbeat. There was no anything which showed he was alive. Right into the emergency room of the nearest hospital. They rushed him in there. They put an ECG onto his heart. Flat line. No discernible heartbeat. They put an EEG onto his brain. Another flat line. He was dead. But he was also very lucky. He told me later, I've given the game away, haven't I? He wasn't dead, because he told me all about it afterwards. His doctor that day had migrated from India, and he had heard that in deep meditation, you can suspend all of your life activities. And he knew that he'd been meditating. So he decided to give this guy a chance before he sent him to the morgue. They put defibrillators on his chest, passing electric shocks, boom, boom, which took him an inch or two off the stretcher. Nothing worked. Flatline. They did it many, many, many times. Until, he told me, he decided to come out of his meditation. Beep, beep, beep. Both monitors perfectly normal. And, you know, he bent up, what am I doing in here? I was in my bedroom. How did I get here? He hadn't heard any of the sirens. He hadn't felt any of the electric shocks from the defibrillator. But he'd been perfectly aware all the time, deeply inside, in the realm of the mind, which is totally separate from the brain and the body. Because remember, the brain and the body are inside the mind, not the other way around. A different way of looking. Now, I hope that stirred a few people up. Because when everyone thinks the same, no one thinks at all. And I'll just finish my presentation with a challenge to science. Because on the walls of the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge when I was there, there was some graffiti, brilliant graffiti, which said, the eminence of a great scientist is measured by the length of time they obstruct progress in their field. Thank you.
Thank you, Ajahn. And fortunately, we're going to invite some scientists who's not too... Okay, may I invite three scientists to join the panel with Ajahn. They are Nama Dr. Barry Kersant. Venerable is now the visiting professor at the University of Hong Kong, and he's teaching both at both Faculty of Medicine and Center of Buddhist Study. Let's welcome Lama. And also, I would like to invite Professor Sun Kwok. Professor Kwok is Dean of Science at this university. And he's also the chair professor of physics. Another scientist, Professor Elsie Chen, who's also the moderator of today. He's the chair professor of pathology of the University of Hong Kong. Please feel free to turn me up. And I would like to Professor Chen to moderate the panel discussion.
Thank you very much, Walter. Good evening. It's the first time I've moderated, so in order to prepare myself, I obviously went to Google and what are the things a moderator should or should not do. One of the things that came up, and I think is very relevant, it just says, good luck. Well, I'm not sure I've understood everything that Asia has said, but in a way that's good. If I understood everything, then I'll be thinking the same as him, then we wouldn't be thinking at all, okay? What I got out from the talk by Asia was more from the angle of science. I understood it as time and universe having no boundaries, a finite volume. But when it came to the meaning of human life, I really had to struggle. Maybe I have too much brain and not enough consciousness. There's too much there. So it, to me, there's still something to be, I think, got out from our discussion. Mind, meditation, deep meditation states, I think, is a giveaway about understanding the meaning of human life. But I now want to get a response from the Dean of Science, who actually is the author of a very famous book called The Cosmic Seeds of Life, is actually on sale outside. Professor Sun Kwok is one of the world's authority on astrochemistry and stellar evolution. He's been following the nature of stellar dust that we can detect. And his book talks about making a a case that human life from science, the origins is helped by the evidence from this discovery. So I'm going to put forward to Professor Sun Kwok his view about the meaning of human life in the universe, certainly from the science point of view, and also to hear a bit about his response to A.J. Brown. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I first have to admit that I know nothing of Buddhism, and whatever I'm going to say are strictly from the point of view of science. And I want to go back in 5,000 years, because human beings, as Ajahn has said, has always had a very close connection to heaven. Our ancestors, in fact, not that many hundreds of years ago, they don't have access to TV or computer games, and as soon as the sun goes down, they have nothing to do. What they do is with their family, they go out and sit down on the grass and look at heavens. They see the stars turning, they see the sun and the moon and going around, and that is their only entertainment. And actually, our ancestors, going back 4,000, 5,000 years ago, were very careful observers of the heavens. Now, all this is lost to the modern man because we are too busy. We are now in the city. We are obstructed by light pollution, by air pollution. We have artificial lighting. We have many other distractions, and we lost in many ways this tie to nature. What did they see? Of course, they see the sun going around every day. They see the stars going around every day. But they were careful enough. 4,000 years ago, the Egyptians, Babylonians, the Greeks, they knew that the sun is moving slightly slower than the stars. The stars are faster than the sun by 4 minutes every day. And they look at the rising and setting of the sun, which is very easy to observe. The sun would rise at a different time every day. They rise from a different direction every day. And they change throughout the year. The moon also moves. The moon moves 13 times faster than the sun. And they were very curious why, on one hand, the universe, the celestial bodies, are so regular. They have so predictable, coming back through patterns, and yet these patterns are complicated. And the regularity is what prompts humans to think that we do have a connection to heaven, we are capable of understanding heaven, but this understanding is not trivial, is not simple. However, that comes to the beginning of science, that using very simple observations technique and simple mathematics, the Greeks at 400 BC or up to 200 BC, they knew that the Earth was round. Not only it was round, they knew exactly how round it was. The size of the radius of the Earth is to within 3% of our modern values. Aristarchus was able to determine the size of the moon, the distance to the moon. Now, although these are heavenly bodies supposed to be very far away and very distant and seems to be incapable of being understood by human beings, and yet by mind, by human reasoning, and by simple observations, they were able to extract knowledge of the celestial bodies. So that is really the first demonstration that the human mind is capable of a lot, and that laid the foundation of our current religion of science, believing that through reasoning and observations, we are able to understand the world around us. And in that way, we can say that astronomy was the first successful science. Through the construction of telescopes, and now, of course, in the last 300 years, with sophisticated instrumentations, now, of course, our view of the universe or our place in the universe is very much different. We now know that our Earth is one of the 8 planets in the solar system, and our whole star, the Sun, is one of 100 billion other stars in our own Milky Way galaxy, and our own Milky Way galaxy is one of 100 billion other galaxies in the universe. Now, it seems that there is a long way through to 4,000 years ago. We have progressed a lot. It seems that we have understood a lot more. We have understood our place in the universe a lot more, but do we have all the answers? Now, there are limitations to science. Science can only go as far as what we can observe. As far as telescope today, or in fact, in the foreseeable future, the only how we can see up to 300,000 years after the beginning of the universe. Now, we can't see beyond 300,000 years of opportunity, but nothing stops astronomers or physicists to speculate or extrapolate from these observations what were the beginning of the universe. Some people we can extrapolate say, oh, very confident to what's happening in the first 3 minutes. Some would say, I can believe in 1,000th of a second, but all these are based on extrapolations of assumptions. There are certain things we thought to be universal, laws of physics, laws of chemistry, or even the laws of biology. That's why we now think it's very likely there are other living things in the universe, because now on Earth, we see that there are simple forms of life, bacteria in Antarctica, in very cold conditions, in the desert of Chile, very dry conditions, very hot places, in the thermal vents under the sea, there are also life. And these conditions are not too far away, for example, from the surface of Mars. So why not there were living things on Mars? So at this time, we have a lot more hope that we believe we are getting very close to seeing other life forms in the universe. Now no one can tell what that form would be. Are these biological organisms, are they similar to ours, or governed by total set different laws of biochemistry or biology? Now, I want to say this in a way that in one hand, we have a lot of success stories in the 4,000 years of development of science. On the other hand, we cannot ignore that there are boundaries of science beyond which we may never be able to understand or penetrate. John mentioned what is before the Big Bang, and that is something that science will never be able to answer because that is beyond what we can observe. And I think this is my counterpoint to the from the scientific point of view.
Thank you very much, Professor Sun Kuo.
So we're beginning to unpack that even for science, the understanding of the mind in imagination, in observation, and everything is important. But in a way, now I want to come back to our other panelists, Dr. Barry Curzon. He is a medical doctor as well as a Buddhist monk. He has a special interest in the dialogue between Buddhist ethics, modern science, and psychology, in development of compassion for those working in the caring profession. And he's also an expert in understanding altered states of consciousness. That was mentioned by Aja about deep consciousness and mind, and I'm getting to have a sense that we can never understand what is the nature of the universe ourselves until we understand our mind. So I would invite Barry, as he's a good friend, I'll call him Barry, who's also given a talk on altered states of consciousness, about whether he can throw some light on the topic, the meaning of human life, or I could turn it around and say the meaning of human death in this universe. So Barry, to you.
Yeah, I guess it may be true that that friends think alike. Maybe it doesn't come down to truth, but sometimes friends think alike. Because what was going on while I was listening is that there's something missing here. In the topic, the title for tonight, it's talking about meaning. And we're talking maybe about half or at least one part of what's meaningful, that is truth. I actually don't think there's so much contradictory nature between science and Buddhism. Of course, they're not the same. Where I think there's a difference, a fundamental difference, is ethics. And I think where the monks come from and people that identify with Buddhism, or for many other, probably all religions for that matter, is compassion, is love. And I think we've not been talking about that yet. And I think that's something very, very important. And I do believe that when people meditate, particularly in a Buddhist tradition, maybe others, deeply, that what begins to happen over time is that compassion naturally starts to be experienced. There were some studies that Ajahn referred to before we came. Actually, I think it was Professor Lee referred to these when we were sitting in the back room, that took place about 10 years ago at the University of Wisconsin. And they were looking at long-term meditators to see if their brains were the same or different than others. And the types of meditation that the monks or the participants, the long-term meditators, were asked to do, one of them involved compassion. And in fact, much of the data that showed differences in the brain structure and function actually was during that meditation, where compassion, this deep meditation, including compassion, was part of the exercise, was part of the experience. If I'm asked, what's the meaning of life, I often say to serve, to help. I think that is the meaning of life, because it brings happiness. It brings happiness to us. It brings happiness to those we serve, at least if we have skillful means and know how to serve in a way that helps others. And this is very much part of the mind. We can't divorce love and compassion in a discussion about the mind, even the deeper levels of the mind. In fact, at the very deepest levels, love and compassion are not distinguishable from the Buddhist wisdom, the sunyata, the emptiness. They are very, very close. In fact, probably just about the same thing. So compassion is something that really moves us in a healthy way, in a way that builds a healthy family, community, and society. So I think a discussion of compassion and love is central to understanding the mind. Now, I do agree with the vastness, you know, the biggest. Of course, this is the mind. And in some approaches to reality, everything is the mind. Because everything is, you know, at least when we communicate, everything has a... a structure, a syntax based on language, and that is the mind. And so, from one perspective, everything actually is the mind. So that I have no disagreement with, and I think the scientists might also not have disagreement. You know, most scientists don't believe in the mind. They don't believe in consciousness, as Ajahn said. They believe it's some kind of a spin-off from the brain. But when we begin to be open to the possibility that there's something that is not form, it's not shape and color, there's not matter, that there is something different that we call experience, then the whole world opens up and allows for love and compassion as well as wisdom.
May I... follow up on this point, because I was very impressed by Ajahn's illustration of seeing the father, the elephant, and the mountain, and everything is within the size of the eye. And also on your comments about mind and reality. Now, scientists or students of science often think that there is a reality out there. It is up to us to discover it. As a matter of fact, all our interpretation of what we see are coming from our mind. For example, our description of the universe going back 4,000 years ago to the Egyptians, to the Babylonians, to the Greeks, to the modern times, we all rely on mathematics. But mathematics is a human construction. It's something created by human mind. It's not something real. There's not. There may be 10 million different kinds of mathematics. There may be aliens. We have a completely different set of mathematics. So they would have a totally different description of the universe, even though the universe may have a so-called existence of separate reality. What we interpret the universe today, to a great extent, are our own mental construction. That is our interpretation of what we are seeing through observations.
I think you might have an easier time without your hair. You're sounding very Buddhist, Professor Kwok.
I am losing my hair quickly.
But I would always say that I have met people like Roger Penrose. He came through, and a good friend of friends of Stephen Hawking's. And these scientists refuse to admit even the possibility of a human mind. And it's very much part, you know, of the brain. And this is actually a little bit disappointing this evening, that everyone agrees with each other. So but there's a huge consequence to the materialism of most scientists today, when they refuse to even contemplate the existence, you know, of a human mind. We get people like Richard Dawkins and his selfish gene idea of the meaning of life. You know, just a selfish gene, the whole meaning of life, according to Richard Dawkins' book, was just, you know, to keep the human race going. You know, the genes inside of you, for them to be perpetuated, you know, through the sexual union of human beings. The gene is actually using you, according to Dawkins. You know, you are the slave of the human gene, so it can keep on existing, you know, in our universe. And such materialism has, I reckon, has had a huge impact on our modern culture, you know, where we just focus on things rather than people. You know, where we don't focus on compassion, we focus on the economy. Where we don't focus, you know, on kindness and wisdom and peace, we focus on acquiring more things. We're very much a materialist society, and basically because there's a materialism in science, which blocks, you know, love is just a chemical reaction between two people. You know, boy meets girl, and that sort of, creates, you know, this, pheromones, you know, from boy to girl, and that secretes, oh, there's all sorts of other, oxytocins, and that explains human love. And many people actually say that, and to me that is very demeaning. I mean, demeaning in the sense of taking away the meaning of life. And I think that's a great danger in our modern world. You know, we're just reducing things to just chemical reactions, to physical stuff, and taking away, you know, the joy of love, compassion. We're actually destroying the meaning of life. That's my view anyway, and I think it's a danger. I think there's a great battle being made at the moment between science, you know, and just the human emotions. Anyway, that's what I feel. What do you reckon?
Well, I've been told I can't agree with him. Yeah. Yeah. Please, please.
I think it's time for me as a moderator to turn up the heat again. You know that the title of a talk actually is like a way to talk about the Dharma. So we just put the title there to get the thing going. One thing I like to pick up, I think Asia, you said more than once, there's no need for a creator. No need to invoke a creator. And yet, I think of people in science, you know, Francis Collins, who actually was responsible for ensuring the sequencing of the human genome. Now, he is a very staunch Christian. He believes there's a creator. And Sometimes when I think and I look at the beauty of simple things like, you know, you can say a snowflake or a flower, look at the intrinsic beauty, or the human body, I mean, it's so beautifully constructed and to work in a way, in such a smooth way, in a way to correct its deficiencies, its balance, you know, the restore of the internal environment. There must be something out there that is enabling this. So I just want to hear the response from, you know, why do these people believe in a creator God or a creation, in a creator? Is it just a mind? Or can science, in a way, I was trying to push this idea of the cosmic seeds and the experiments we can generate under conditions we don't know, we can generate life forms that we have not seen before. So just some comments and response. Asia looks as though you're ready with that, okay.
Okay, I remember reading Christian theology, St. Augustine, who was, you know, one of the big minds in Christianity. And he came up with this really beautiful argument, very simple. He said, no, he assumed God exists. And he said, God cannot be omnipotent and also all-compassionate. It cannot be a loving God and omnipotent, because suffering exists. Ebola exists. Cancers exist. Your kids die when they're only 1 or 2 years of age. And so suffering is. And so he argued that, you know, if God was omnipotent, was all-powerful, then he can't be compassionate. He could have done something, and he didn't. I'm just trying to stir you up, okay? Or, you know, if he is all-kind, so then he can't be omnipotent. Because if he was really kind, he really had love, if God was love, then what the heck is he doing? He should be, you know, using his love. It's obviously he's restricted, or she's, or it's restricted. He may be gay, I don't know. But I get into trouble here, but I'm stirring up, okay? What is happening here is, you know, they can't be both all-loving and all-powerful, because suffering exists. And that was actually a beautiful argument, very simple, easy to understand from a sort of a great theologian. And so I think a lot of times, you know, the idea of a God is like wishful thinking. And just before I came here, actually, no, before I went over to Malaysia just in mid-December, I was talking with a Christian, and he came up to me and he said, you know, Ajahn Brahm, nothing is greater than God. And I said to him, yes, actually, I agree with you. Nothing, emptiness, is greater than God. And he said, that's not what I meant. That's what Buddhists mean.